The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. So here we are. It is the day of reckoning for what feels like an interminably long and rancorous campaign season. So long and so divisive that it's exposed deep fissures within the American electorate, which will not likely be smoothed over after the results are tallied, especially since the traditions and legitimacy of our democracy have been called into question, even threatened in ways unprecedented in recent memory. But not in American history. For some perspective, we're turning to Brady Carlson, late of NHPR, now All Things Considered host at Wisconsin Public Radio, and forever the author of Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and afterlives of our nation's leaders. Brady, so great to have you with us again.
So great to be back with you, Virginia.
So a lot of people are saying that this election is unprecedented. It's never been so contentious, so ugly, and the country's so divided. Is that true?
I would just point to an election in which one party referred to the other as having been the pimp for the Tsar of Russia,
Woo!
The other party accusing that candidate of being an adulterer and mass murderer. We are certainly in unprecedented times in some ways, but to say that this is the most contentious election of all time, hardly.
When was that?
That was in 1828 between Andrew Jackson, he was the one they called the mass murderer because he had fought plenty of duels, and John Quincy Adams, who was the sitting president at the time but had been the U.S. minister to Russia and knew the Tsar, and I guess the Jackson people thought, well, then he must have been procuring lady friends for the Tsar.
Wow. Always back to Russia, huh?
It always comes back to Russia. It's a theme.
So it's either been, as some people call it, a dark carnival of an election or just one that's complicated and always changing. We've had the rise of outsider candidates, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, that incited a lot of contempt for the Electoral College system and raised the possibility of contested conventions. Now the fairness of that system is being again raised. So bring us back to that rationale for the Electoral College system, which of course leads to
Hamilton, because all roads lead to Hamilton. Essentially, the founders wanted to put some distance between the masses who they felt at that time were not as well read, not as well educated, and therefore too prone to being swayed by the feelings of the moment, that they would sort of chase after something that they would regret later on. And so originally the idea was that the people would only indirectly choose presidents by picking these electors who then would be wise and respected members of the community who would choose the president themselves. That was the idea anyway. And It was set up in that each presidential elector would get two votes. The top vote getter would become president. The runner-up would become vice president. The issue in one of the earliest elections in 1800 was that we'd had the rise of political parties proposing a slate of candidates for president and vice president. And the electors for one of those tickets was so disciplined that they actually wound up giving the same amount of votes to their presidential candidate, Thomas Jefferson, and their vice presidential candidate, Aaron Burr. Now, the Constitution said at that time, as it does now, when there's no majority in the Electoral College, the House of Representatives chooses the new president. And at that time, there was enough support for Aaron Burr, or at least opposition to Thomas Jefferson, to keep the House from choosing an outright majority. And so it took the House 6 days, 36 ballots, before they eventually did choose Jefferson. And depending on which histories you read, one of the main reasons that Jefferson won and Burr lost was the intervention of Lin-Manuel Miranda. Oh. I mean, Alexander Hamilton.
He was around then?
He was around back then, and he was putting out those great rhymes. Hamilton was lobbying for Jefferson, who was his longtime rival. said essentially he was the lesser of two evils because he very much disliked Aaron Burr. And I guess Aaron Burr kind of proved him right a few years later.
Wow, so a lot of parallels. But still, this points to it not really being an election for the voice of the people. It's those that know better.
And sometimes it's even gone further. I mean, there have been plenty of examples in American democracy for all of its high ideals where we have had vote buying and fraud and nefarious business of all different kinds. Let's also remember that for decades and decades in the early days of the country, that only a select few of people could vote at all, even for those electors. Women couldn't vote. People of color couldn't vote. Many white men who didn't own property couldn't vote. Those barriers have come down. But, I mean, we come out of a democratic tradition that in its earliest days, in the colonial period, George Washington himself spent time as a candidate for Virginia's House of Burgesses trying to buy votes with huge amounts of liquor that he distributed out to his potential supporters. So that's part of our democratic tradition, too.
Okay, so let's go back to this. The Constitution says when there's no majority in the Electoral College, the House of Representatives chooses the next president. Of course, within recent memory, the Supreme Court chose the new president. But has this happened? Any elections that get thrown to the House?
It did happen one other time in 1824, and this one's a little less complicated. Essentially, there were enough candidates that had regional support that nobody won an outright majority in the Electoral College that year. This was a pretty high-profile set of candidates. John Quincy Adams, he was the son of President John Adams. He was the sitting Secretary of State at the time. Andrew Jackson, the hero of the War of 1812. And Henry Clay, who was a great legislator and Speaker of the House at the time. Now, Andrew Jackson finished first, but he didn't have a majority. That's why it went to the House. And overseeing that House voting was Henry Clay, who had a lot of sway about who was going to end up as the next president. The House wound up choosing John Quincy Adams, who had finished second place over Jackson as the next president. And then John Quincy Adams chose as his new Secretary of State Henry Clay. So Andrew Jackson is convinced that he finished first in this election, no matter whether it was a majority or not, that Clay and Adams had struck a sort of corrupt bargain to cheat him out of being the next president of the United States. So Team Jackson, in the aftermath of this election, began a four-year effort to essentially oppose the Adams administration at every turn, with the hopes of electing Jackson president in 1828. And that's exactly what happened.
We're talking with Brady Carlson, author of Dead Presidents, about America's history with controversial, contested, and messy elections. Is there one election that stands out as, you know, the most controversial, the worst, most contested, contentious ever?
The messiest of all time, for my money, is the 1876 presidential election, the most controversial one of all. It's largely forgotten today because the candidates in that race were very forgettable. The Republicans chose Rutherford B. Hayes of Ohio, a compromise candidate, not the most charismatic guy in the world. The Democrats chose Samuel Tilden of New York. And here's what happens. Tilden wins the popular vote, although we should say that vote was full of irregularities, including voter intimidation by Southern Democrats. Tilden wins the popular vote, but is one electoral vote short of the presidency. Hayes was even further behind in the Electoral College, but Republicans disputed the results in three states, each of which essentially wound up with two sets of election returns. To settle this, Congress sets up a special commission to decide which results are the official valid results. The final membership of that commission consists of 8 Hayes-supporting Republicans and 7 Tilden-supporting Democrats. Can you guess who won? So Hayes, who was himself an honest guy, ended up as the winner of this very controversial election. And because of the accusations that it was a stolen election, the opposition called him Rutherfraud B. Hayes because of how he ended up as president. In exchange for winning the election, the Republicans made a deal with Democrats that the Democrats would no longer contest the results of the election as long as the Republicans agreed to remove most, if not all, protections for African Americans in the South. So this 1876 election may be forgotten, but it did pave the way for the Jim Crow era and many of the difficulties that would come in the American South.
Okay, how about the closest ever election?
one of the closest in popular memory anyway, other than the Al Gore George W. Bush election, was in 1960. John F. Kennedy was the popular Democratic senator from Massachusetts, but he was running against Republican sitting Vice President Richard Nixon. And there wasn't a whole lot of difference in substance policy-wise. There was a lot of agreement on many of the big issues of the day. And so as a result, it was a very close election, maybe 100,000 votes or so, splitting the two candidates. Here's the key point. Because it was so close, there was a lot of rumors that the Democrats had rigged the vote in Kennedy's favor in crucial states like Illinois, where Richard J. Daley was the mayor, and Chicago has that reputation of being the city where even the dead vote early and often. So Nixon apparently believed some of these stories and considered calling for recounts or legal challenges. And there were some attempts to do that at some point. But in the end, Nixon very publicly said, "I will not challenge the results of this election." Depending on who you believe, he did it because he wanted to make sure that the democratic process endured and was strengthened. And other people say that Nixon decided not to challenge the election because he didn't think he would win the challenge. Either way, Kennedy was making light of these rumors when people suggested that his dad, the wealthy politician Joe Kennedy, had been buying votes on his behalf. John F. Kennedy joked that he had gotten a telegram from his dad that said something to the effect of, "Buy as many votes as you need, but only as many as it takes to win, because I'll be damned if I pay for a landslide."
Well, so you mentioned, of course, the 2000 vote. This was Bush, which ended up in a Supreme Court case, Bush v. Gore. And I think a lot of people are thinking about that now, just because there has been talk until very recently about the possibility of the election being rigged. There's a lot of anxiety or some kind of national PTSD that we're all sinking back to. What was the legacy of that 2000 election?
I think what it reminds us of is that how you conduct an election can have even an unintended effect on what happens in the results of that election. The way that you design a ballot, and people who remember the 2000 election remember that famous or infamous butterfly ballot where the names of the candidates were on one side and the actual line where you would poke the hole for the candidate you were supporting was on a different side of the ballot. Mm-hmm. I mean, people will sometimes misunderstand how you cast a vote for someone, and they may actually vote for someone they didn't mean to. Some states will have paper ballots. Some use electronic machines that don't have a paper record, and people will get concerned whether there's any evidence of rigging or fraud or hacking or even just plain mechanical failure. People will get concerned, is my vote being counted in the way that I want? You'll also hear people say that, you know, with the rise in early voting, are those ballots being secured in a way that makes me feel comfortable? I'm not saying that there's evidence of vote rigging or a problem with election security. I'm saying that in an era where people increasingly distrust institutions and in an era where states are conducting elections in very, very different ways. You have a state like New Hampshire where everybody has to vote on election day for the most part. And you have other states where people can vote by mail and that everybody gets the chance to have that ballot and just mail it in. People start to ask themselves those questions of how comfortable do I feel about this election? And I mean, anytime that a president who lost the popular vote winds up winning the Electoral College and winning the presidency, people start to say, hey, what's with that system?
Right. And the question of faith in the system, which, of course, we've heard a lot about in the last couple of weeks, especially threats from a former Trump campaign staffer of a bloodbath if he loses, even a former congressman, you know, saying calls to arms if Trump loses, and certainly from his supporters. Has there been any precedent in American history of threatened armed resistance after by the losers of a past election, or has it ever happened?
This has happened repeatedly. It happened several times during the 1850s. This is in the period just ahead of the Civil War. This is a period where tensions between North and South, especially over slavery, have become increasingly heated, and you're seeing violent fights break out between members of Congress in the Capitol. And in 1852, which is when New Hampshire's own Franklin Pierce is elected, and then 4 years later in 1856, when James Buchanan of Pennsylvania was elected, there were some veiled and somewhat not so veiled threats by Southerners saying that we will leave the country and we might defend ourselves. There might be an armed insurrection storming the Capitol. That was all tamped down because the pro-slavery contingent's favored candidate wound up winning. But it became clear as the 1860 election drew nearer that the anti-slavery candidate, Abraham Lincoln of the new Republican Party, was likely going to win. And the tension grew and grew and grew. And Southerners said, if that abolitionist from the North winds up winning the White House, off we go. And if it means civil war, then it means civil war. And we all know what came next.
Well, Brady, I guess this whole American democratic experiment, 240 years on, think it's working out?
Wasn't it Ben Franklin who said that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others?
I guess this is the one we've got.
We'll take it.
Brady Carlson, All Things Considered host at Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a little tear right there for that one. And we're hanging on to him as our All Things Presidential Historian. He's author of Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. Brady, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Much more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've heard throughout this election cycle that voters are more partisan than ever. But there is at least one thing that Democrats and Republicans agree upon completely: bumper stickers, buttons, and posters. No matter whose name is being promoted, political parties tend to follow the same marketing gospel: clear brand identity. Graphic designer Michael Beirut explains why.
A typical campaign button for a Republican candidate usually consists of that person's name made as large as possible on a blue field with some red graphic accents that usually take the form of stars and stripes. The name is often white because that gives you the maximum contrast between the white and the dark blue. Democratic candidates' buttons look almost exactly the same. In fact, I'd be hard-pressed to come up with any particular difference between the two of them. One of the discoveries I made as a designer was that what I was taught in school was a little bit different from what is really true. For instance, I was taught in school that what the function of design was to help everyone stand out, everyone look different. But what you discover, actually, is that people want to look different, but not that different. And so, I think every single person campaigning for office, whether they're doing it for dog catcher or for president, tends first of all to just resort to the tried and true things because that sort of projects, you know, I'm a normal person and I will provide a normal, happy life through my services as an elected representative. I think if people tried to be like daring or strange or out there in a way that, say, a consumer products brand can do, they tend to look alarming in the long run.
Thank you for your vote.
I think that if you're marketing a product or a company, what you have is a fairly relatively static thing to market. You know, I mean, Rice Krispies in the box will taste like Rice Krispies, and they don't waffle. Rice Krispies don't make gaffes in debates. Rice Krispies don't photograph badly when their hair is messed up. Rice Krispies don't get caught unaware. Rice Krispies don't have sexual indiscretions. You know, they simply sort of sit in the box, and you can sort of put whatever package you want around it. I think candidates, because they're people, because they're human, and because they've led full and presumably interesting lives and will continue to lead those lives as the campaign is going on, are much more unpredictable in their behavior and, I think, resist packaging a little bit. One of the few instances that I can remember of a candidate really trying some unusual things to advance his cause as a political campaigner was George McGovern in 1972, when he ran and spectacularly lost to Richard Nixon. He commissioned a series of commemorative posters from well-known artists, including abstract artists like Larry Rivers, which led to the effect of a poster that said McGovern for president, you know, on the bottom of it. And above that was this, you know, incredible Larry Rivers miasma of color and, you know, slashes of lines and things like that. Completely abstract, completely even messy. And I'm sure that to an average voter, all that seemed to illustrate was the presumed dementia inside McGovern's mind. So when people step outside the line of what's considered conventional wisdom as far as these things, they've been soundly punished for it, and they retreat back to the eternal verities of blue, white, and red stars and stripes.
And that piece was produced by Hilary Frank. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On this show, we try to give listeners a little bit of a break from the political races. But throughout this very, very, very long election season, we did manage to nab an interview with one of at least 1,900 people running for president, transhumanist candidate Zoltan Istvan. Seems like forever ago that we spoke with him about transhumanism and his bid for the White House, and that's because it was. Here's a clip from our interview in March of 2015.
Most politicians, when they run across their political platforms, they're not pushing science and technology as their foremost concern. Well, the Transhumanist Party is. We're putting science, health, and technology at the forefront of everything we do politically. So when it comes down to talking about even taxes, or it comes down to defense, or it comes down to any of the major policy issues, we look at it from a very scientific and technological point of view and ask how science and technology can help those policies out.
Since then, Zoltan has been zipping around on his immortality bus, campaigning on issues like artificial intelligence, genetic modification, space travel, along with the usual stuff, immigration, cybersecurity, and healthcare. According to one poll, Zoltan is fourth among third-party candidates. But with the race coming to a close, he's also feeling deeply disappointed in the process. His article, What I Learned by Running for President, appeared in Motherboard. And Zoltan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, when we last spoke to you, you were not hoping to win, but as with many third-party candidates, to introduce some new issues to the voting public. Feel like you've been able to accomplish that goal?
Yes, dramatically. Actually, when I look back after 730 days of running for president, transhumanism has had a chance to grow considerably. Just because the media has been more interested in it, and a presidential candidacy gave it some legs to stand on, some legs to explore with. So I've been really happy with the result of growing the transhumanism movement through this candidacy.
But clearly not entirely happy. What have you learned about, even getting on the ballot?
Oh, yeah. When it comes to actually running for president, I've become very, very disappointed. It's an incredibly difficult challenge to be a third-party candidate and get any kind of real leverage in terms of actually winning the election. I mean, it's an impossibility. I feel like if you're not a billionaire, there's really no way to get on all 50 state ballots. If you're somebody like myself, a transhumanist, it's really hard to get someone on the street to sign off on that and to get a signature. So you might actually need like 2 or 3 million signatures, and some signatures can go as high as $5 to $10. So you're looking at $10 million just for somebody like me to get on all 50 state ballots. It's virtually impossible. My campaign has not gone over, spending $100,000.
Well, so you have to have a big ground game. And now for the first time, the Libertarian Party has a candidate on the ballot in all 50 states. Shouldn't it take some time to build that sort of operation required to run the most powerful country in the world?
Well, so I actually think not. I think if they're going to tell you in school that anyone can run for president, they should mean that anyone can technically also win that presidency. What I think, one of the main things I'm really pushing for now near the end of my my campaign is a ranked voting system where essentially a vote that you put out there doesn't get wasted on a third party. If that third party can't actually technically win, it would then go to somebody else. Like for me, they'd vote me. Maybe then their second choice would be Hillary or something like that. that would mean that all candidates would have a solid shot at actually being voted into the presidency. And I think I understand a lot of people's argument, like, yes, it should take the Libertarian Party 40 years to get someone on the ballot in all, you know, 50 states. But I think that that hurts American politics. I think that's why you're seeing such anger in this election, is we don't have more choice. And while that choice is out there, there's 1,900 candidates, you know, outside of four of them, nobody even knows them barely.
Well, what would it take then? Of course, people talk about the influence of money on elections. And in some ways, the failure of Jeb Bush and the rise of Trump, who did not have all that political machinery or donors in place going into this election, made it, you know, and made it far. That kind of refutes those claims of money in politics making the candidate. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yes, it does refute it. And, you know, again, I'm not trying to say that I'm my system is the best one. What I'm trying to say, though, is I felt like after over two full years of campaigning, while I may have, you know, changed my movement and given it a lot of media coverage, I certainly didn't do anything in or very little in terms of actually reaching the American people and getting them to consider voting for me. And main reason is because it's an impossibility on a sheer technical level to get ballot access. In California, it takes millions of dollars to get on the state ballot, my home ballot, and you know that's just totally unfortunate. But I think the most important thing that, you know, needs to happen here is that the government should get involved in polling. If there's 1,900 candidates that have registered for the FEC, well, I believe that the government should help poll those 1,900 candidates. It's very un-American. This is the bottom line. It's very un-American to have 1,900 candidates running and to not be showcasing more of that diversity in American politics in the 2016 election.
Well, Soltan, given this, of all of the outside issues that you have tried to bring to the table with your candidacy, what has been the most appealing one so far, an issue that you think is really sticking in people's minds?
The by far the most important issue and the one that's really sticking is a universal basic income. I feel like there is an absolute audience for everybody in America receiving a basic income that will pay for food and housing and things like that because of automation, robots taking jobs, and software taking jobs. It really has resonated with the American people, and it's broadened my own campaign to a whole new class of a group of people, especially the Bernie Sanders people.
So what do you think? Are you planning to run again in 2020?
Yes, I do believe I'll run again in 2020. I'll probably run for the Libertarian Party. You know, I would begin a campaign in about 23 months, as crazy as that sounds, a new one for 2020. I did have the honor of interviewing to be Gary Johnson's vice president about a couple months ago. He did say no and chose Governor Bill Weld, but as a result, I became quite a bit closer with the Libertarian Party.
Well, it's Election Day, Zoltan. What are you doing?
Well, I'm trying to get the vote out for myself. I'm not on any official ballots, but you can write me in a number of states across America, including New York, Florida, and as well as New Hampshire. So, you know, if you do decide to do that, bear in mind that my full name is Zoltan Istvan Jerko, and that's my FEC registered name. And yeah, please vote for me.
Well, Zoltan, all the best.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
Zoltan Istvan, candidate for president for the Transhumanist Party. You can hear our original interview with him, which has a lot more on the party's platform at wordofmouthradio.org. There is a long list of complicated, well-intentioned, out-of-the-mainstream Americans who have made a bid for the presidency, most of them men. This year, when the first woman candidate for a major party has a solid shot at winning, we're taking a look at another historical game changer, the first woman to run for U.S. president ever. And this story comes to us from producers Joe Richman and Samara Freemark as part of Radio Diaries series Contenders.
My name is Scott Claflin, and I am a descendant of Victoria Claflin Woodhull. The first time I began to become aware of my relative was in 1964. When the Republican Senator Margaret Chase Smith was running for President of the United States.
Senator Smith posing now for the photographers, wearing her traditional robes, looking very happy and very pleased about the whole thing.
They were talking about history being made, with Margaret Chase Smith being the first woman to run for president. We're watching, and my dad said, "That's not right. These guys don't know what they're talking about."
My name is Amanda Friskin. And I wrote the book, Victoria Woodhull's Sexual Revolution. Woodhull came from an unusual family, the Claflins. She grew up in a small town in Ohio, but they moved a lot. Kind of traveling salesman, catch as catch can. And at the age of 14, Woodhull was married off by her parents to a man who proved to be an alcoholic. And she had a pretty hard life with him. She was traveling around when she said she had a revelation to go out there and declare her right to be a woman in public and to be a powerful woman. And so she packed up and came to New York.
This was an era where a woman could not vote, could not enter a restaurant, a store, an establishment of any kind unless she was escorted by a man. It was controversial for women to do anything, but she had the foresight not to accept the way society was.
She started a radical newspaper. She opened the first woman's stock brokerage firm. But the thing that gave her national fame was when she sent a card to the New York Herald declaring her candidacy for the presidency.
Letter to the New York Herald, April 2nd, 1871. I claim the right to speak for the unenfranchised woman of the country and announce myself as a candidate for the presidency.
For a woman at that moment to be running for president, when most women in the country couldn't even cast a ballot, made this a pretty extreme act.
If the men should see the women going to the polls.
In the 19th century, lots of women were making claims about women's rights. You might think that women suffragists turned to Woodhull, and some of them did. But the suffragists in the 1870s tended to be middle class to upper middle class women. More conventional, more serious. Woodhull was really an outsider, not well educated, rather uncouth. And some of them just thought she was insane.
Though all the men should frown on us when going to the polls.
The thing that really made Woodhull notorious was when she gave a speech in New York City on November 20th, 1871, entitled The Principles of Social Freedom. In that speech, she claimed marriage was a form of tyranny for women.
It is high time that your sisters and daughters should no longer be led to the altar like sheep to the shambles. The sexual relation must be rescued from this insidious form of slavery. I protest.
She was speaking, and a woman yelled out and said, "Do you believe in free love?" And she said, "Yes, I believe in free love."
Yes, I am a free lover. I have an inalienable, constitutional, and natural right to love whom I may, to change that love every day if I please, and neither you nor any law you can frame have any right to interfere.
She was really just making a rhetorical point in the middle of a much more complicated speech. But that's the one that everyone put in the paper. It became known as her free love speech. And it gave her instant national fame, but not necessarily the kind that she had hoped for.
1872, she was nominated by the Equal Rights Party at a convention in New York City.
It was very easy for the press to lampoon this. They thought it was ridiculous.
About 800 members of the Woodhull Wing assembled yesterday morning at Apollo Hall. The exercises were opened by the singing of Hail Columbia, after which a frivolous and tedious discussion on irrelevant topics arose.
The Equal Rights Party advocated women's rights to fair wages in the workplace, shorter work days, and they also advocated civil rights for freedmen and women. And when the discussion over the vice presidency came up, they nominated probably the most well-known African-American man at the time, Frederick Douglass. But they didn't ask him first, and he never accepted the nomination. He felt that it was probably wiser not to dignify the nomination with a response. The convention was really the high point for Woodhull, and after that, things really went downhill for her. As a result of the notoriety of the nomination, Woodhull was evicted from her home, and she had some trouble making ends meet. She then lashed out at a former ally, Henry Ward Beecher, who was a very prominent minister, saying that he wouldn't support the free love cause, he wouldn't support social freedom publicly, that he was a coward for not doing that because everyone knows Beecher is privately practicing free love, that he had dozens of mistresses, and she then decided to publish the story. That didn't help her situation. It made it a lot worse.
She was arrested for sending obscenities through the mail under laws that no longer exist, the Comstock laws. And on election day, she sat in jail.
Woodhull wasn't on the ballot anywhere on the election of 1872. So in terms of actual voting numbers, we have no record that anyone voted for Woodhull. She was a woman who has a terrible reputation, who may have at least temporarily done the cause more harm than good, but she's the first woman to put her name out there and say, I want to run for president. It makes for a very complicated founding narrative for women. You want someone really beyond reproach. You want the George Washington for women. And you don't get that with Woodhull. She was a flawed first, but she's still the first. I mean, she's the one we have to live with.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the ballot initiatives for Massachusetts voters, legalizing recreational marijuana in the state. Among those funding the opposition, billionaire Sheldon Adelson, the Knights of Columbus, and the Catholic Church.
Question 4 would allow thousands of pot shops and marijuana operators throughout Massachusetts, in neighborhoods like yours. Shops that sell pot edibles that look like candy and high-potency marijuana. In pro-pot states, incidents of drugged driving and fatal car accidents are up. More pot shops than McDonald's and Starbucks combined. Higher potency, dangerous drivers. It's the reason health
Mom,
professionals are urging you to vote no on 4.
That ad is in heavy rotation on Boston television stations thanks to an $850,000 donation from the Boston Archdiocese, the very same organization exposed for shielding and reassigning pedophile priests by the Boston Globe, an investigation which was the subject of the Oscar-winning film Spotlight. Emma Green covers politics, policy, and religion for The Atlantic. She reported on why the Catholic Church is leading the fight against legal pot in Massachusetts. Emma, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what exactly is on the ballot for question 4?
This would set up a system for regulating legal recreational marijuana use. It is a technical ballot that is all about the procedure around legal pot.
Political ads are not known for their accuracy. How about this ad, the claim that there would be more pot stores than McDonald's and Starbucks? And also, you see a little kid looking at these treats in a window. Would that actually be allowed?
In other places where marijuana has become legal, there have been businesses that have sprung up selling edibles, which are marijuana in the form of candy or other foods. And certainly there have been shops and new businesses around this industry. That's one of the reasons why advocates say this is actually good for states, is it creates an opportunity for industry. In terms of the widespread extent, it's really hard to tell. But I will say that it sounds implausible that McDonald's would be handing out marijuana with its coffee cups.
$850,000 is a lot of money. Why is the church sinking so much into fighting legal pot?
Not only is it a lot of money, it's coming late in the game. When I spoke with the Archdiocese, they suggested that the cardinal there has been praying about this, and he finally decided that this was important enough to give that much money, even from an archdiocese that has been financially struggling for years. They think that this is a central part of their mission and their ministry. The way that they help children, families, and the poor would all be undermined by legal pot, they argue.
So that's Cardinal O'Malley, by the way. But is this his own decision? I mean, I'm not remembering hearing anything from Rome or theologically about marijuana use.
certainly Pope Francis has come out in recent years against the liberalization of drug laws. And this is something that the Vatican has stood against for a long time, which is a permissiveness in law against drug use. Specifically in the United States, Catholic organizations have been against the legalization of drugs for a while. So this isn't a policy change from the church side. However, this is a huge thumb on the scale for the church to make in a political ballot initiative, particularly so close to the election itself.
And this is kind of surprising since the church largely opposed the prohibition of alcohol in the early 20th century, didn't they?
There is an irony, and particularly when it comes to Boston. This is a town that historically has large populations of Irish Catholics, and Irish Catholics tend to have a strong drinking culture. Indeed, in churches, many events circulate around alcohol. So there is some tension in the stance that the church is taking on marijuana versus its posture towards alcohol. But the church leaders have said that they believe legal weed would be a gateway drug to harder drug use, such as heroin.
So to hear from the other side, advocates for legal weed point to social justice issues, that sentencing guidelines related to the war on drugs, for example, low-level drug arrests disproportionately affected men of color. So what has the church done on the other side of that? Anything to support people who are affected by those kind of policies?
This is one of the most interesting things about the church's move, and particularly the Archdiocese of Boston. They have been on the more progressive side of American dioceses in that they have a lot of programs that are dedicated to supporting the poor, supporting the homeless, and helping counsel people who have recently been out of prison. But they would argue that unlike progressive advocates for legalizing weed, having legal pot would only undermine people who are trying to rebuild their lives after coming out of prison, or families that perhaps would be affected otherwise by having a man who uses pot at home. So they believe that legal weed would actually hurt the poor, hurt the homeless, and hurt families rather than helping them.
The church, as you mentioned, is under considerable financial strain, millions of dollars in payouts related to the sex abuse scandal and settlements. How can it afford this?
Well, there's an argument to be made that it can't. The Archdiocese of Boston has closed parishes, it has shuttered schools, and it recently dismantled a palatial building that used to house the archbishops and the cardinals who resided in that archdiocese. It still had an operating loss in its budget in recent years. And as you say, it has an enormous budget for continuing to make payouts and compensation to victims of sexual abuse. This is a very big donation. It's nearly $1 million. And so there is an argument to be made that they put a chunk of change down that will take away funds from other initiatives and other efforts by the church to help the poor.
So as you said, a late buy for the church. What's the likelihood that that's going to make a difference?
Well, the last time I looked, the polling numbers were pretty strongly in favor of the ballot initiative, not by margins that are insurmountable by any means, but it very much did look like an uphill battle, and particularly considering the fact that this donation came at the very end of October. This is, you know, a week, 10 days before the election. It's a pretty long shot. It's a Hail Mary pass, if you will.
Emma Green, staff writer at The Atlantic, covers policy, politics, and religion. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
You'll find a link to read her article, Why the Catholic Church is Leading the Fight Against Legal Pot in Massachusetts. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free and Delay. Lots more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio, and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. You can follow election coverage from NHPR and NPR throughout the day, with a live election special beginning at 8 o'clock tonight. And you'll get a much deeper, real-time view of the issues, the candidates, and the election at nhpr.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whatever happens, we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.